Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello and welcome to the Big Change Podcast, where we are exploring how ordinary Christians can change their world. My name is Jonathan Wilson, and I'm your host. Today, we're joined again by Andy Crouch, who is Partner for Theology and Culture at Praxis, a venture building accelerator in the U.S. Andy joined us in episode 5, which was a great conversation, and you can hear more of that, obviously, if you go back and listen, and you can also hear more about Andy and his thinking about redemptive business. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you, Jonathan. Great to be back.
Great to have you. So, Andy, as you know, this series has been about many different aspects of big change and the role that ordinary Christians can play in it. But it remains a fact that Christianity throughout history has also been very patchy. Indeed, sometimes the behavior of Christians, the behavior of the church has been quite horrific. And there are examples in the news pretty much every year. So at some point, we are faced with that burning question, but what about when the church fails? You know, here we are discussing a podcast about large-scale change. It's all very adventurous and exciting, and yet we have to face up to this reality of our own history. So to start off with, before I pull Andy in and get into some conversation, I want to share two things up front which may surprise listeners. The first is that I've never experienced more opposition, more hostility, or more personal harm than I have from other Christians. And that includes Christian leaders and Christian organizations, or in some expression of God's church. At the same time, secondly, I love the church. I can walk into a local church and it's messy and the sermons aren't preached very well and people don't welcome you. And yet there's something about this place that these are God's people. And however messy we are, however disobedient we probably quite routinely are, there's something of this body that is very, very special. And so, yes, I love the church. And yet, along with many others, I've been impacted negatively by the church and its people. Of course, it goes without saying that I've probably done my fair share as well. So this question, what about the church's failures, is what Andy and I will be looking at today. And we're going to look at it, in a sense, from two sides of what might seem like opposite ends of the spectrum. We're going to look at things that Christians have done in history, particularly missionaries, but things that the church has been part of in history about which there's often been actually misunderstanding and misperception, where we've actually probably done well in a sense, and yet the reputation that comes with those parts of history have been very negative. And so Andy and I will be offering some correction around that. On the other hand, we have to face up to the genuine incompetence, failure, and outright wickedness that has been in the church and now and in history. But the reason for looking at these is not, in a sense, to set up a kind of a game where there's a points competition and we're trying to figure out, has the church's total accumulation of points on its good side outweighed its total accumulation of points on its bad side? Instead, what I hope listeners will hear is that we're going into the heart of what makes the church actually who it is and what makes the church a gift to the world. We'll start, Andy, with talking about missionaries. So obviously, I grew up the son of missionaries, and listeners will have heard in earlier episodes that my grandparents were missionaries and my great-grandparents were missionaries. But when I first moved to the UK from having grown up in Indonesia, I found that the average classmates in my British schools and later in university were implacably hostile to missionaries. And in fact, there was a big either BBC or ITV documentary at the time that was put together by a guy called Julian Pettifer that was singularly opposed or, hostile to missionaries. And so this was in the air at the time. And anytime somebody found out that I'd grown up as a missionary kid, I would usually get some quite vociferous, reaction to that, either getting angry about missionaries and their participation in the colonial enterprise, or about missionaries arrogantly imposing this alien message on indigenous peoples. So that's a common stereotype, but Andy, I think you and I both know it's not entirely accurate. So I'm curious, Andy, before we get into the discussion, and Andy, we can take this in any number of directions at the start here, but what did you grow up believing or hearing about missionaries?
That is such an interesting question, because I grew up in a quite secular environment in the United States and in a family that did not practice Christian faith. So, you know, any thoughts I had about missionaries seemed like from a long time ago, which was not true. I was growing up in the 1980s, which are actually a time of tremendous mission activity from the United States as well as other parts of the world. And yeah, it seemed like it was from a long time ago and far away. But I don't know that I encountered maybe the same hostility that you did. You may have been in settings where people were more ambivalent about the colonial history of their own country and their own heritage than was the case when I was growing up. And then I came to faith myself in my mid-teenage years and gradually discovered through friends who were preparing to be missionaries, and I'm thinking about friends at university who then actually have spent the rest of their lives outside of the U.S. cultural context, specifically as translators. And so when I think of missionaries now, I think of these specific individuals I know and have met who have, you know, the definition of a missionary, left their home culture, embedded themselves in many cases for life or for a long season of life in another culture. And I know these folks so well and know the care with which they do what they do, whether it's translating into a particular dialect of Arabic, for example, or just being present in a local community, that the idea that it's this sort of rampant bulldozing enterprise just doesn't resonate with me. Although I also know, I kind of step back, I've done enough reading and I'm aware enough to know that if you look at even many contemporary expressions of what's called mission, you know, what comes to mind most, and I actually was part of producing a documentary about this, not quite as negative as the film you described. But from the U.S. context, we have this thing called short-term missions, because the U.S. is very proximate to other countries and places in our kind of catchment area, you might say, the Caribbean and Mexico and Latin America, where it's very accessible for Americans to get there for a very short amount of time, which is a real change in how mission is conceived. Mission used to be a lifelong, you know, enterprise, and now you can get on a plane and go for 5 days from the U.S. to a country like Haiti, or Mexico, or Guatemala, or the Dominican Republic. And so this has become almost a rite of passage for American Christian young people in particular. And when it's described as mission, it actually is accompanied by a lot of complexity, to say the least, in terms of who has cultural power, what is the transaction actually that is happening in these ostensibly spiritual trips. So I've also seen the shadow side for sure. But when I think about the people I know who don't just do short-term mission, but who actually dedicate their lives to it, it strikes me as a pretty amazing expression of kind of the ultimate expression of Jesus's description of love of neighbor as extending your neighbor beyond the person who you would naturally encounter, and actually going to that distant place and discovering you have neighbors there as well and figuring out how to love them.
Yeah. And that has been a feature of mission throughout the church's history, as well as other expressions that are less well considered, like what you just mentioned, the short-term missions that we get today, which are almost like a hit and run.
In more senses than one, yes. Leave behind a lot of damage. Yeah. Don't leave your name. No accountability.
Yeah. But before we, Andy, go back in history, because there's some very fascinating examples, and more precisely, some very interesting studies done by sociologists that reveal patterns in Christian mission and history that I want us to talk about today. And you and I have both looked at these quite carefully. But before we get into that, I recall one of my younger brothers being in a class in Canada in high school, and the teacher was making critical comments about missionaries. And at some point, my brother raised his hand and said, "Can I make a comment?" She said, "Yes." He said, "I don't like to say this, but I think you're being a racist right now." And she was obviously quite shocked. And she said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, I grew up amongst the kind of people that you're talking about. And the way you've just described them, you would think that they don't have the capacity to hear a message and decide for themselves whether they like it or want it. Yeah. But rather, they're so gullible that they would just be easily hoodwinked by these predatorial white missionaries. And I think, you know, that's just getting into some detail, but I think that's a part of the dynamic. Our critical view of missions has often been colored by our paternalistic view of people who are not like us.
Yes, yes. Not just the view and assumptions about the missionaries themselves, but about the people that they are kind of moving among and moving to. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. There are assumptions on both sides, perhaps, about who is going to whom and under what conditions.
Yes. Well, let's dig into history a bit here through two scholars that you and I have talked about a lot. One is Robert Woodbury, and the other is Peter Berger. So Robert Woodbury, who published a piece in the American Political Science Review in 2012, that was the result of 14 years of research. Now, you and your team, when you're at Christianity Today, did quite a substantial article on this. So maybe for context, could you paint a picture of Woodbury's research and some of the key things that he was highlighting in it?
Yeah. Well, the backstory for me personally is quite wonderful. It was one of these moments of serendipity that you just hope will happen in your life. I was at a birthday party for a gentleman, an older gentleman in Bangalore, India, of all places, a number of years ago in the mid-2010s. At this wonderful party, there was this tall, lanky American fellow, and we got to talking. His name was Bob Woodbury, and I had never heard of him before, though I had heard of his father. He is himself the child of missionaries, and his father was quite a celebrated missionary in, I believe, Afghanistan or Pakistan, as well as a scholar of missions and missiologist, you might say. So I had sort of heard of his father, but Bob was at this point had done a PhD in sociology and was teaching sociology and had been for a long time at the University of North Carolina, which is a very distinguished sociology program in the United States. And he started telling me about his research, and we ended up in one of these just extraordinary conversations for, you know, probably an hour, kind of at the edge of this party. You know, real social science research proceeds in a way when people develop new methods that give us insight into very large-scale historical trends that we haven't been able to quantify before. And Bob had managed to uncover a bunch of records, political records, public health records, in a number of nations, specifically in West Africa, though he and his team had gone on to do this in countries all around the world in many, many different cultural settings, but he started his research in West Africa. And then he was able to correlate these kind of public records with the records of missionary activity in these different countries. But, you know, his field, political science, is a field that is not friendly to the idea that religion has been a major force for good in the world. And in fact, the most surprising thing or interesting thing about political science often is how much its studies, whether qualitative or quantitative, completely neglect the effect of religion at all. A religion is often just not even engaged as a possible factor in why certain countries, for example, have functioning democracies, while others seem to very quickly fall into autocracy. You know, so for one thing, his field is sort of indifferent to religion, but when the topic is raised, it's hostile to religion. But what Bob Woodbury found is that beginning, and this is why it was published in American Political Science Review, that beginning with the political indices of what we consider to be a healthy society, that is democratic participation, transfers of power without violence, you know, these other kind of features that we often aspire to, for at least the liberal democratic world aspires to for nations, that you could actually correlate contemporary political health with the presence of a certain kind of missionary in the 18th and 19th centuries, the first kind of wave of mission to that particular country. And, you know, one of the things you struggle with in social science is how you can have good enough controls on your experiments. We know that great experiments have a very clear way to control for the sort of input you're looking to test, whether it makes a difference. And human affairs are so messy and human societies are so complex that you rarely can find really good comparison groups, right? Control groups. But in the case of mission, because, and this is all intertwined with colonial realities, because different European powers claimed different kind of slices, say, of the coast of West Africa. Those different powers had different rules for who could represent the Christian faith in those places. And that led to very different patterns of how mission activity was carried out, or if it was carried out at all, in the kind of early colonial period. So this gives us a perfect kind of control group, because you can look at one country, you know, Sierra Leone, right next to, I don't know, you know, Cote d'Ivoire, and they're all right next to each other, fairly culturally similar overall in most ways, though, of course, different tribal and ethnic groups within each. But they have very different histories of who brought the gospel to them. And it turns out that when a certain kind of missionary that Woodberry labels conversionary Protestants, so our modern word usually for these folks now would be evangelicals, they were evangelical Protestants whose goal was to convert people through a profession of faith, through their own profession of faith, that when they were the missionaries, and we can maybe talk more about why it might be that this was the group, you could actually look at contemporary political health in these countries and find that they were healthier by a significant, like actually the most significant margin of any factor political scientists have thought about testing. Because there's lots of reasons you might hypothesize that a society becomes more or less a healthy, say, modern democracy. And political scientists have actually tested a lot of those. And you get these very weak correlations. Like you can find correlations, but very weak. And the presence of conversionary Protestant missionaries 150 years ago was the most robust factor in political health today.
Well, what I found really interesting when I was reading his work was, many things. I'll try and unpack some of them. Firstly, was to date, and I really worked hard to try and find out who has tried to critique his work.
Yeah. It won the most prestigious prize for political science research. I mean, everyone sees that on its own terms, it is robust.
Yeah. So the only refutation that I could find was weak, and Woodberry has a response to it that you can find online. But the second thing that stood out to me as well, just at the macro level, before we dig into the actual content of his findings, is that he also did a kind of apples for apples comparison. And he was able to demonstrate that what you detailed and he would summarize as stable, self-governing democratic societies in the West followed the same pattern, that where there had been conversionary Protestant activity in those countries in a period that you could say was the formation period,
right,
of who those countries are today in their current state, there was the same pattern underlying it. There are these key characteristics of conversionary Protestant activity that you find in these various countries that Woodberry studied, in contrast to missionaries, say, from the Catholic Church or other expressions of the Christian faith, who tended to focus on, because of their assumptions in terms of the theological frameworks they're operating from within as Christians, they would focus, for example, the Catholics would focus on training just clergy, because you're not that concerned about the masses being educated. And they would train clergy and they would train elites. And Woodberry sees this pattern showing up. You know, you can have a Francophone country where Catholic missionaries were present and right adjacent to it, similar tribes, similar cultures, but a country that was probably now Anglophone in which conversionary Protestant missionaries were active. And you have these very, very different outcomes in terms of stable, self-governing democracies. And I'll just add quickly here, I was fascinated to see that Lamin Sane, who I think is a Nigerian theologian and scholar based out of, I think, Harvard, argued that the African independence movements in the 50s and 60s and 70s emerged very much, or were direct descendants of these features that had been established in these local cultures and were possible because the missionary commitment to indigenous languages and to translation meant that people had their language. Language is a dimension of, or an expression of, or in a sense embodies culture, captures culture linguistically. And so there was a cultural integrity that was being maintained even as people were becoming Christians. And this sense of the value of your own culture and the identity that you can maintain because you still have your language and your culture was crucial to successful independence movements. So that's a And, you know, he was separate. I don't think he was reading Woodbury's work, but that was what he was noticing.
Yes, absolutely. And Lamansana's work is very important in so many ways. He had a lifetime of incredible, fruitful research from an African perspective on the effects of mission in the history of the African nations and cultures. And translation is a real linchpin. And, you know, I think that highlights something really interesting about this particular part of history. These missionaries who were, you know, from different parts of Europe, many from England, they had a whole range of what we might consider enlightened or unenlightened views about the people and ethnic kind of realities they were entering into. And they were not all progressives in any sense of the word. They were not modern. They were 18th and 19th century people who are very different from how almost anyone listening to this podcast would see the world. And their views of the people they were trying to reach were not all views that we would probably hold or find comfortable to imagine a Christian holding, to be totally honest. But it's just the truth. And it really doesn't matter is the fascinating thing. It's they were not democracy activists. They were not literacy activists per se. But they did have this underlying belief, maybe not even fully articulated by themselves, that every person they encountered in whatever cultural context was capable of hearing and responding to the message of God in Christ if they had access to it. And then they had this, as you mentioned, this kind of consequent belief that the Bible needed to be accessible and could be read and accessed by anyone if it would just be made available in their vernacular, in their mother tongue. So they did invest incredible energy, not just in translation, but in literacy. And that just was not, in fact, how the Catholic missions to this part of the world operated. Now, there's a variety of ways that Catholics have gone out into mission in the world. But in West Africa, that was not the dominant kind of, in a sense, so we call it anthropology, as in the understanding of who the human beings are that you're with. The conversionary Protestants had an anthropology because of their faith that really allowed the effects of their work to lead to these outcomes today that we consider very beneficial, that it's not, they might or might not have ever imagined them, and they really weren't thinking about them. They weren't thinking, how can we form stable, self-governing democratic societies? They themselves did not necessarily live in such societies at the time. And yet the knock-on effects of their commitment to bringing the gospel close enough to people that they themselves could understand it and respond to it, just become incredibly powerful. Another thing I'm not sure we've mentioned directly is the equal education of women. That is the belief, the sort of unexamined belief almost, that women should have just as much access to scripture, therefore literacy, therefore certain kinds of cultural power as men, just was part of their sort of, it was baked into their understanding of mission. And there's one other thing that I think it's important to note, and that's that generally, and this is partly because of what it means to be Protestant in the European context in this time, generally these conversionary Protestant missionaries were able to operate quite independent from the nation or imperial power that they might have operated under. Whereas the Catholics, because of the way that Catholic societies fuse the church with the state more than Protestant tend to, those missionaries often were more constrained by their connection to colonial powers, both political and economic. Whereas the Protestant missionaries really had often, not infrequently, the political and economic representatives of the empire were quite opposed to the missionary activity, sometimes because they saw that it was creating problems for their own imperial agenda. And in a Catholic setting, those forces won. There's this kind of amazing movie made about this in the South American context called The Mission that kind of shows a group of Catholic missionaries who were basically overridden by their own ecclesial authorities in the interests of the Catholic powers, the national powers, who are sort of bulldozing over indigenous communities. In Protestant contexts, basically the church was, the representatives of the church were sort of free to do their own thing. And I think this will become an important theme as we continue this conversation, which is your proximity to power as a Christian. You always sort of wish you had more power to get done the things you want to get done. But in the history of the effectiveness of the church in bringing flourishing in the world, it's when it's most proximate to power that it's actually, it does the most damage. And it was actually the conversionary Protestants' distance from power. They were lower class. They were not elites. And that actually insulated them from the ability to kind of turn imperial power to their own religious purposes. And when you have that kind of distance from power, actually healthy things happen. And when you have proximity to power, more complicated things happen.
Yeah, there's so many aspects of what you shared, Andy, that I want to respond to, but I want to pull back a bit and share some detail that Woodbury touches on in his research. In fact, I think he may have actually written up on this in a separate article. One of the things that has also been consistent trait, and you touched on it just now, Andy, with regards to Catholic missionaries operating in South America, has been efforts throughout history for foreign missionaries working amongst indigenous people to protect them from exploitative powers. And that comes right through to the modern day, where in the Philippines, the most active defenders of the rights of indigenous peoples in the southern Philippines in the 60s and 70s and maybe up into the 80s were Jesuits and evangelical missionaries. In the island where I grew up in New Guinea, my dad and another missionary by the name of Sue Trenier basically put their visas on the line in their ability to work freely in Indonesia in order to persistently stand up for the rights of tribal people to their land and to prevent them from being basically forcibly removed. And the government at the time, local government or national, we don't really know, was using the event of a natural disaster as a way of saying, we're moving you for benevolent reasons. But at the very same time, the geologists from the mining companies were busy researching this terribly unsafe area that the tribal people were supposed to, you know, leave behind. And so my dad and Sue, they succeeded. And to this day, you know, the people have been able to stay in their territory. So these have also been very distinctive traits of Christian missionaries in the history of the church.
And, you know, I think it is very important to say it's not Catholic versus Protestant per se. It is proximity to or detachment from power. Because, you know, we've been using the phrase that Woodbury uses, conversionary Protestants. There were other kinds of Protestants who were present as Christians in the colonial enterprise, and sometimes as missionaries, who were much closer to the state. And those Protestants, you don't see the effects. So it's not a Catholic versus Protestant thing, except insofar as there has been a different kind of prevailing kind of political reality for the Catholic Church in many places. But the Catholics who distanced themselves absolutely operated with exactly the same insights and instincts and effects as the conversionary Protestants did. So yeah, it's the line falls not between Catholic and Protestant, but between proximity to the state and the imperial power and distance from it.
And there's a great line from a British commissioner who was responsible for Botswana back in the 1800s, where he's reacting to the successful efforts of missionaries to cooperate with local chiefs to obtain the protection of their right to their land.
Very inconvenient.
Yes, very inconvenient to the colonial enterprise and to all the white settlers and traders attempting to make something out of this diamond-rich region. Charles Ray says, and you have to imagine the plum in the mouth, the posh British accent at this point, where he says, I'd like to stick my missionary crowd down into a mine, onto a stick of dynamite, and blow the whole damned lot to the heaven they're always bleating about. So, and it's consistently the case that missionaries have often drawn the ire of the powers that be at the time. So to your point about proximity to power, distance from power, I think that's very important. Let's shift here and talk about Peter Berger and what he discovered in his work.
Now, Peter Berger is a very interesting figure at a personal level, because unlike Bob Woodbury, he is not the child of missionaries. He is a liberal Protestant, would be how he would have described himself. The late Peter Berger, he died a number of years ago now, and really quite a secular man in some ways. And he is part of this wave of sociologists who predict that as modernity reaches more and more parts of the world, that the world will go the way they saw at the time they thought the West was going. This story has turned out to be more complicated also. Namely, religion will just die away. Of course, what happened is history kept happening, and a good empiricist keeps looking at the data. And Peter Berger, who himself has no, you know, it's not his personal devotional project, you know, to advance the cause of Christianity, but he looks at actually the continuing kind of relevance of religion, and in fact, the resurgence of religion, even in some ways in the West. And like a good sociologist, he gets really interested in this in the last part of his career. This would be in the 1990s in particular, 1990s and early 2000s. And so he gets very interested specifically in most of all Pentecostalism, which is this religious movement, Christian religious movement, of course, which has come out of nowhere in history, or specifically came out of a place called Azusa Street in Los Angeles in the United States in the early 20th century, the 1900s. And is now a vast and growing and very fast growing religious movement. And its growth is in places that are modernizing. So Berger gets very interested in this form of religion that actually grows as societies become more modern rather than dies away the way that kind of the mainline denominations of Europe and the Americas have died away. And he just becomes fascinated with it. He starts studying it. And he starts to discover, first of all, some interesting reasons why perhaps it does grow and thrive as people urbanize and modernize, but also the cultural effects. Like Woodberry, he's interested in, you know, what are the political outcomes? What are the public health outcomes? And he finds that Pentecostalism, again, unlike more state-aligned religions, because Pentecostalism often thrives in fairly Catholic countries, especially in the Americas, that when Pentecostalism arrives, you see a decline in addiction. You see a increase in family formation. You see healthier economic activity. And he starts asking, why in the world is this happening? Because, you know, keep in mind, too, and I studied at Boston University where Dr. Berger taught. And when you spend your time in the halls of a university in Boston, Pentecostalism seems like a very backward way of looking at the world. You believe that God speaks to you. You believe that healings happen. You believe they're dead or raised. I mean, it sounds primitive, pre-modern, you know. And how could this pre-modern or primitive kind of way of looking at the world actually have all these beneficial outcomes in the modern world? And, you know, Berger, to the end of his life, I think never, he certainly didn't become a Pentecostal. I think maybe his own faith was a little bit reawakened over the course of his life. But he concludes that very much like Woodberry's story in a very different time, because he's studying now, he's not studying history, he's studying contemporary realities, that the way that Pentecostalism kind of elevates the dignity and responsibility of the individual, because it is quite an individualistic faith, unlike Catholicism, which is practiced kind of in extended families and in mass. Pentecostalism addresses the individual, and it does it in a very modern way, very individualistic way almost, that actually that has had these knock-on effects that elevate the individual's sense of responsibility for themselves, especially men, it turns out. They come to faith in a Pentecostal environment, and they're challenged to stop drinking as much, to treat their wives with more respect. The reality is the abuse of women is endemic in many cultures, but in Pentecostal churches, that's not really accepted, and you're called to a higher kind of moral standard. And it also, Berger came to believe, unleashes kind of entrepreneurial and economic activity, because you start to believe that you have agency in the world. If you have agency in the spiritual world, where you go to church, you're being taught to kind of interact with spiritual powers and overcome them and claim victory over them. Well, maybe you can also claim that kind of agency in an environment where you've been told you and people like you don't have any economic options. And so you start to create economic options. So Berger becomes very fascinated and spends the whole last kind of season of his career on kind of uncovering this consistent phenomenon again in places very different from each other as Korea and, you know, South America and Africa. And in all these places finds, look at what happens. This kind of new modern religion, which I would say has some of the faults of modernity and some of the faults of Western individualism. But just like 18th century mission had some of the faults of European kind of anthropology, you might say, but it nonetheless has these really beneficial effects to its adherents. And then kind of they spread out into the culture at large, even if you aren't yourself a Pentecostal. So just fascinating, fascinating kind of contemporary findings from our own time.
If you've been enjoying the conversation so far, please review this episode to help shape future content on Reframed.
So Berger talks about the Protestant ethic, and he describes it as a behavioral bundle that includes austerity, saving, hard work, rational thinking, making sure you're educated as best as you can. But in addition to that, Berger also points out that women are crucial actors in the Pentecostal movement. And you touched on this when we were talking about missionaries in the 16th and 17th and 18th centuries. And I think back to the tribal community that I grew up in, which was quite misogynistic in its pre-Christian period. And as they became Christians, those behaviors just quite literally started to fall away. Now, if you were a Yali woman in pre-Christian society, back either when I was a very little boy or before I was born, and you accidentally entered sacred ground, like a grove in the forest that was dedicated to the ancestral spirits, at that point, you'd forfeited your life. So a friend of my dad's, he lost, I think, his cousin. She was thrown into the river because she'd done this when she was a girl. She wasn't even a full adult. If a woman accidentally overheard sacred speech or lore, she might be killed. More likely, they would sacrifice a pig and then cleanse her ritually with blood in her ears. And then she would in some way, receive a penalty. The first time the Yali heard the Bible read to them fluently in any church in their tribe was when a young Yali woman read the Bible to them in their own language. And nobody stopped listening because it was a woman. Something profound had taken place. And one of the things that I often think about is that when we arrived among the Yali, my mom and dad, if they had kind of taken their leaf from subsequent methods for driving social change, they would have probably run seminars on, the dignity of women, or in the case of warfare, on the dignity of men, humans altogether, and that cannibalism is not a good thing. They did neither. In fact, if they tried to do either of those things, they would have probably been, driven out of the community. I think what I'm trying to drive at here is that there's a fundamental dynamic at the core of what happens when people convert. And it's not that they've changed their beliefs per se, but it's that they've encountered the living God himself and are experiencing his work in their lives, even as they do obtain new information, absorb it, and it goes to work in them. You can't explain the changes that we're talking about purely at the level of information.
Wow, that's so right. I think it's very dissonant from a kind of modern view, which is just give people information about the best behaviors, whether it's in public health or here's how to have a functioning democracy or, whatever, like let's just hold seminars basically. And that will lead to change. It's very hard to square that with the evidence of what actually seems to be underneath, even changes in those areas in public health or in democracy. But it's very congruent with the Christian belief that what is at the heart of all human misbehavior and misbelief is false gods. That is, we've lost our connection with the true God, our true creator, and the one in whose image we've made false images and tried to reorient our lives around those images. And when you do that, there's this cascade of the way you treat other people, the way, in a sense, you treat yourself, the way you treat the natural world, that is damaging, comprehensively damaging, and leads, of course, to what the Bible also talks about is injustice. But for the Bible, idolatry and injustice are these seamlessly connected realities that all have their root in the rejection of the true God and the true image of God in human beings. And everything else is downstream from that, And the modern way, the post-Christian secular way, is to try to, you know, work downstream from the idols. And you don't make much progress, it turns out, often. Or it's like, you know, you sort of push one balloon underwater and another pops up. And you try to have a feminist movement without the image of God, male and female. And you find, as we're finding in the United States today, that young women actually are more sexualized and experience more oppression in an environment where allegedly they're supposed to be more dignified and where by some measures they're doing better. And, you know, unless you go back to the source of the idol and dethrone the idol, not simply by saying it's an idol, but saying, here is the true God. Here's the message of the true God. Here's the love of the true God. And people have an actual powerful encounter with the love of the true God. You're going to have a very hard time changing these downstream kind of social realities that we properly care about and see as troubling. So, yeah, it's validating in a way for the core claim of Scripture, which is there is a true God and there's a way to know him and he's made known in Christ. And you can have a powerful encounter with that reality that will reshape you and the society around you. That's the kind of biblical vision.
Yeah, yeah. Which brings us to the other part of what we said we were going to talk about today, which is that this same church through which we've seen the kinds of amazing contributions to societies in history that we just talked about, this same church has behaved badly. And what do we do with that? What do we do with the elephant in the room of a church that claims to be an outworking of the love of God, a group of people that claims to be and believes that they are people who have said yes to the love of God and yes to Jesus, and yet leave in our wake appalling demonstrations of, you know, human behavior? Or maybe it isn't bad behavior per se. It might also be the failure to act, the widespread inaction on the part of Christians. You know, Tracy and I were out of South Africa for nearly two decades, and when you've been away from a situation for that period of time and you come back and you see how little has changed, you can say, there's millions of Christians in this country. What have they been doing for 20 years? Like, we're not talking about 5 years, we're talking about 20 years. And of course, people have been doing things, but when you see that the inequality is still so pervasive, you can't help but ask the question, what has the church been doing? So there's either perpetration or inactivity. And in my own reflection, I realized that within myself, part of what's going on is genuine distress over genuine problems. And part of what's going on is simply that I'm embarrassed. If I'm being honest about myself, my concern isn't so much about Jesus himself, it's about how we're performing and how we're appearing to be. And I think I realized for myself, but I think this is probably common amongst all of us who are Christians, is that we desperately would like to not fail. And yet we do. It's very humiliating. So Andy, I mean, we could go at this in a number of directions. I have my own thoughts, but I want to give you a chance to speak in to your own reflections about this.
Hmm. There are many, many failure modes in human life. There are many ways for things to go wrong. But there's one central way that I think does the most damage and that kind of compounds all the failures that are inevitably part of human life. I mean, human beings are fallible. You know, we are prone to fail. And that is actually not necessarily, that's not a terrible thing. That makes us dependent on one another and humbles us and so forth. But the thing that exacerbates all this, that heightens the damage, that prolongs the damage, is essentially pride. And pride is an option when you have power. Now, there's ways to be prideful without power, but power allows you to persist in pride like nothing else. Pride being the declaration of independence from God and other people, and the desire to remake the world in your own image and for your own purposes. And the belief that you can get away with it also, like the belief that you can actually do that perpetually and you'll never get caught out and you won't fail. That is all kind of bound up in pride. And pride is aided and abetted by proximity to power. And so I think the issue is not exactly failure per se. We'll misunderstand one another. We'll neglect to care at crucial moments for each other. But if you don't have pride, those things get repaired. So I really think when we look at the failure of the church, the issue is not the generic kind of falling short that just is part of being human and part of human systems. It becomes a problem, and it becomes a matter of, I think, appropriate shame. I mean, what you were describing, when you feel embarrassed, it's shame. It's shame on behalf of this institution that I'm connected with and this community that I am part of, whether I like it or not. It's always because of really one of two things. One is the way the church itself creates a kind of scope for the exercise of pride and the abuse of power. That is, within the church, we accumulate power and then we use it. And the other is the church's proximity as a community and as an institution to other forms of power in our world, economic and political primarily. So, you know, to unpack each of those, one reality is every time there's a human community, there's power present in it. That is, some people have the ability to act and are given kind of scope to act. And that's just a reality of human beings. It's how we organize ourselves in a way. And it's not bad per se, but most human beings, when given access to power, our natural proclivity to pride kind of rises up within us. And then we start using the position we have, whatever kind of power it is. And this can be direct kind of power, as in an organizational title or position that gives you kind of a cloak of authority and maybe invisibility in a way to do things you wouldn't do if others could see you or know you fully. It can also be indirect power, the power of gossip, the power of undermining, the power of kind of rumor. And human communities give our pride scope to run. And at its limit case, this always ends up in the exploitation of the vulnerable and in the abuse of those who can't, who have no ability to protest or make their suffering known to the community. And so that's one like failure mode that's entirely internal to the church. In a sense, even if there were no other institutions in the world, this would be a problem. And it's a problem, by the way, from day one in God's own community. You know, all these things you're describing, these are all in the Bible. Like, the failure of God's people to be God's people is not new to the church. It's the story of Israel, but it's also the story of the church as it plays out in history. And then the other is when the church as a community or as an institution, as we've talked about already, becomes proximate to other forms of power, which frankly often are much, in our modern world in particular, the modern nation state, the modern economic engine of our time. These are have degrees of ability to afford human beings independence from God and others through political or economic power that frankly people maybe dreamed of, but never had in other parts of history. And whenever the church has been entangled with those kinds of power that don't even pretend to bend the knee to the authority of God, the way the church at least would ostensibly seek to bend the knee. Caesar has no interest pre-Christianization of bending the knee, but you get close to Caesar and you get a lot of Caesar's affordances, a lot of what he's able to get done and the speed at which he's able to get things done. And the expense that he's able to go to get things done. And just so in the modern world, when the church gets proximate to power of other kinds, it gets proximate to pride, and its own pride is fed. I think that's the heart of the failure we have to wrestle with. And then you can drill down to any specific instance that causes you pain or lament or shame. And I just guarantee, like, trace it back a couple steps and you're going to see pride and power are the real heart behind whatever the sort of pointy end of violence was. It almost doesn't matter. I'm not saying the violence doesn't matter, but if you're seeking to understand it, what's really driving the spear is pride and power.
Yeah. And to drill into that a bit further, at a level that I think is important in terms of the average listener, power comes in many forms. You know, knowledge is power. Yes. Let's, you know, and this will show up. Let's be specific to the Christian context. Again, if we think about ways to utilize or deploy power, power is money. Power is best practice in evangelism. Power is the right way to pray. Power is, the possession of a spiritual gift that allows you to prophesy, or somebody else has that gift and you want to get access to it. Each of these things in and of themselves is not a bad thing. These are all resources to the church. But there's this deep, deep need for us to be our own boss, to be our own savior, to take a hold of these things and make them work for us.
This is where I think our sense of shame and embarrassment and the ammunition that Christian misbehavior, both past and present, gives to our opponents, is actually an incredible gift. Jesus endured shame, shame that he did not deserve to endure. There was nothing he'd done that should have been led to shame. And he's exposed, literally naked, treated as the worst kind of criminal, put with the worst kind of people. And because Jesus had no attachment to pride, he endured it. I think when we encounter criticisms of Christianity, especially when they're just, and we're ashamed by what we see, I think we tend to think, well, how do I, like, what's my rejoinder? What's my, what's my counter argument? And that's not to say there isn't another side of the story to tell sometimes, but sometimes the proper attitude is, thank you for the gift of humility that reminds me that nothing I or my fellow Christians do is enough to save the world or even to bless the world. That is only through God. There's this quite extraordinary story of a Serbian Orthodox bishop, Bishop Nikolai Felimirovic, who was in the 20th century a bishop in Serbia, and he wrote a series of amazing prayers that are collected in a little book. And one of the most amazing of them is a prayer for his enemies, in which he asks in all kinds of ways for God to bless his enemies. And here's, I thought it might be helpful to just read a couple of lines of this. Bless my enemies, O Lord, for they rather than I have confessed my sins before the world. They have scolded me whenever I have flattered myself. They have spat upon me whenever I have filled myself with arrogance. Bless my enemies, O Lord. And this is kind of the refrain of the prayer. Even I bless them and do not curse them. And what Vilimirovic is saying there, among many things, is our opponents who highlight our failure and who scorn us because of our failure and scorn the church because of its failure actually are giving us a gift we would never give ourselves, which is a true humiliation of how attached we are to power, how arrogant we truly are, how much very likely had we been in that position of power with those set of weaknesses that that powerful leader had, how likely it is we would also have exploited. And they're giving us the gift of actually the humiliation of the cross that Jesus willingly embraced without deserving any of it. So, the failure of the church can become a great stumbling block. It's terrible when it does, a terrible scandal to belief. But for those who do believe, it's actually an invitation to kind of recenter our belief and realize that this whole story, even the best parts that we focused on earlier in the kind of remarkable flourishing that has come from Christian presence in the world, it is not because those missionaries got everything right about human beings or human society. It is not because Pentecostals got everything right about Christian faith and morality or, gender relations or whatever. It's because God just keeps showing up in this story, this fallible, failed human story, with redemptive power that doesn't operate anywhere else in spite of the failures institutionally and personally. And that's the story, of course, all the way back to Israel. Israel, God's chosen people, which over and over is arrogant and prideful and rejects him and worships false gods and practices injustice. And yet, nonetheless, the story of Israel is the story of God in the way that no other nation gets to tell the story. Not because they're so great, but because God's chosen to reveal himself when they do well and when they blow it. And that's, that's the big change. The big change is not that we have figured out how to be a human institution that brings good in the world. It's that we have been baptized into a story that we don't even own or control, that God is bringing to completion, and that we just get to like be the rescued, like on the flotilla of the rescued out of the sea of human chaos, and including our own.
Yeah. And so to our listeners who are not Christians, I guess our encouragement, Andy, is keep up the critique.
Confess our sins. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at the same time.
Because you're right. You're right. Yeah. Tell us the truth. We need to hear it. We want, at our best, we want to hear it.
Yeah.
And it's just the truth anyway.
Yeah. Well, and at the same time, for our brothers and sisters in Christ, should we be aggrieved over what happens in the church? Of course. Should we lament? Because lament should play a key role in the life of the church and in the life of Christians. But at the same time, the point that we've been making is that the blessedness of the church and the blessing of the church is that it is the place in which God does his work with unworkable people. Whether because we see how the humility and the love that emerges through them results in the kinds of things that we've talked about earlier in the episode, or whether it's in the catastrophic behaviors that need, therefore, his grace and his redemptive power to address. The center of all of that is his forgiveness, his undeserved forgiveness. And I think the what's so important for us as Christians when we're tempted to point the finger or to distance ourselves from this institution is to recognize if we do so, we're distancing ourselves from ourselves, that we are in as much need of grace as this church that we point at. And something that I'll touch on from my own personal life. So early in my career, professionally, but also as a young adult, I engaged in behavior that was very damaging. And as a result, the leadership of the Christian organization I was a part of put me through a disciplinary process. It was very positively done. It was basically remained employed, but I was not allowed to participate in any formal expression of leadership. And then I also went through a kind of a counseling and kind of restorative journey to process what had happened, what part I'd played in it, and to reflect on that. And towards the end of that time, the counselor, he wouldn't have called himself a counselor, he's more like a mentor, is this elderly man that I would meet with once a week. His name is Calvin Cook. And I called him my own personal Gandalf because he had the bushiest eyebrows that came out. And he had this incredible wisdom and grace. And one day he says to me, "You know, Jonathan, I'm going to be recommending soon that your discipline is lifted. I think it's time for you to get going again." At the same time, he said, "In the coming months, you'll be back in leadership. You could be in a church or in an auditorium, and you could be teaching, you could be preaching from the front. And this individual that you harmed could come into that room and could stop everything and could say, he has no right to be there." And Calvin said to me, "Jonathan, she would be right. She would be right. So next week, I want you to come back to me and say, why is it okay for you to be in ministry?"
Wow. Wow.
And I knew where he was going with that. I could have probably given him an answer in that moment. But I came back in the following week and I just deeply knew I have no right, except that by grace, God gives me that not that right, but that responsibility to represent him in this world and to do it in his strength, not my own. And that thorough beating to my pride, which, by the way, hasn't solved the problem entirely.
But it took you one quantum closer.
Yes, let's hope that that's what it did. I trust that's what it did. But it did make me realize that this is what God is doing, I think, for all of his people. He's calling us into this place of abandoning ourselves and receiving what he has. And out of that, we can become vessels of his goodness in this world. And it will still be complicated, and we'll still make mistakes, and we'll still stumble over our own feet, and we'll still at times cause deep offense. And each of those times, we are called back from placing ourselves at the center and placing him at the center. But the key here that I wanted to come back to is that if you know that you need to receive forgiveness, how can you deny it to someone else? And it's that I think is so key to the life of Christians, not just in how they interact with the world at large, but how they interact with one another. And when it's so tempting and easy to point a finger at the church, what would it look like if our posture was, or our because of the receipt of forgiveness that we've experienced, that our movement is toward the ugly church, to extend forgiveness and then in humility with our brothers and sisters seek to continue to put Jesus at the center and be the witness to the world that he's called us to be.
I think this is such a fruitful conversation because it really, I think I would want someone to walk away or to, you know, end this conversation realizing this is actually neither about the church's achievements nor its failures per se. And it's certainly not about weighing those in the balance and figuring out if we've had more achievements than failures. Because when you look at the evidence, you know, even of kind of the best outcomes from Christian presence in the world that we can at least trace historically and sociologically, you end up realizing, oh my goodness, it really was kind of in spite of and around and through very fallible and failed people. And so even the achievements like don't get marked on our ledger in a way. And the failures, as you said, strangely, so the achievements don't get to our credit, but the failures, though they should cause us a sense of remorse and sorrow and shame, I think those are not inappropriate things. They actually lead to the glorification of the God who is worth glory and who does deserve to be trusted and who is acting in human history. And strangely, you know, then you sort of wonder, well, what's my place then? If it's not me doing any of this, you know, what's my place? And the answer is that once you have crossed that threshold, you realize I have no right to be here. I have no standing of my own. I have no achievements to claim of my own. Paradoxically, you are now in Christ and thus able to be part of God's redemptive work. And that's going to have a 1,000-generation effect, not because of you, but because of God. So to the extent that this de-centers us and humbles us and makes us realize we're not the agents of big change, for better or worse, somehow in that transaction of de-centering ourselves, we actually move to the center of God's plan, which is the cross of Christ. So, you know, I would not want anyone to come away from our conversation exhilarated or despairing, exhilarated at how good Christians have been at our best or despairing at how bad we've been at our worst, because really I would want us to come away like in awe that God is working his redemptive purposes out in big ways, lasting ways in the human story. And we're just along very, very, very humbly for the ride.
Indeed. Andy, I think let's end there. That has just been such a rich conversation. To me, it just takes us right to the heart of what it means to be a Christian in this world. I'm hoping listeners hear that as well. Andy, thank you very much for being with me.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ziwani.com.